You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
For the next hour and a half, you will be listening to CITR 101.9 FM's contributions to the 16th annual NCRA Homelessness Marathon. This includes interviews with vendors working with Megaphone Magazine, an audio collage from the Opioid Overdose Awareness Rally, and a discussion on the intersection of homelessness, housing, social exclusion, and addiction. All the recordings you're about to hear are taken from February 21st and 22nd, 2017. Desi Nair, one of our hosts from the live broadcast on February 22nd, we'll shortly go into the history and purpose of the Homelessness Marathon. Stay tuned.
We are broadcasting nationally through Local FM in St. John, New Brunswick as a part of the 16th annual Homelessness Marathon. The project of the Homelessness Marathon is to take media, which has almost always been mired in exclusivity and equitable access, and to use our resources to center the voices of those who deal with homelessness. This is in hopes that we can work towards making media wholly accessible and that we can have a frank and open conversation about poverty, housing, addiction, and other factors of utmost importance from the people who are affected the most by these issues. Now, to do this, stations across Canada joined forces simultaneously to broadcast the event, with stations producing local programming and taking in their equipment out of the station and to broadcast across Canada. Now, this marathon began in Geneva in 1998. Almost 13 years ago, it migrated to Canada with CKUT hosting the marathon at Montreal's McGill University. Last year, it was the first year the marathon was hosted in BC, CIVL in Abbotsford taking charge. This year, the broadcast is hosted out of Local FM in St. John, New Brunswick. CITR will be broadcasting the Homelessness Marathon intermittently throughout the following day, but if you want the full 13-plus hours, make sure you tune into Local FM stream at localfm.ca. This year, there are 11 participating stations and 13-plus hours of programming, so there'll be plenty of time within the next day to check it out. Podcasts for the program will also be available on Local FM soon, so if you're unable to tune in live, you can tune in there. We are currently broadcasting from Megaphone Magazine, which is an organization with more than 40 vendors. Many of the vendors struggle from various barriers, including poverty, homelessness, addiction, and the Megaphone vendor model gives its employees a sense of autonomy, reliable labor, and a voice in the community. We'll be talking to a series of vendors throughout the following hour. So, I have here with me, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Mark Irvine. I'm a vendor here at the Megaphone Street Paper. And I also volunteer at a senior center in the downtown east side.
Nice. And why did you come down to choose here and talk with us for this homeless marathon?
I was invited and I feel that I have some input that would be relevant to the issues that you're raising.
Oh, awesome. Was there anything in particular you wanted to start with in terms of issues you wanted to raise?
The first would be homelessness.
Right.
I recently became homeless due to an illness that affected my ability to keep touch with the organizations like welfare. And then I made the transition from welfare to pension. So I kind of messed that up a bit, and what the end result was, I hadn't been paying rent for 7 months, and that eventually forced my eviction from the place where I was living. So I've been homeless for about 3 weeks, but I found lodgings in the London Hotel, which is a BC housing organization. And I'll be there for the foreseeable future until I can get an apartment.
Okay. And how did you come into joining the Megaphone Magazine team as a vendor?
I was invited. I was first a vendor for the Pivot Hope and Shadows calendar.
I said, how's it been so far being a vendor?
When I'm healthy, it's excellent. I don't make a living at it, but I supplement my pension with it, and that allows me to go to other events that I normally wouldn't be able to make it to.
Nice. Nice. And do you originally come from the downtown east side, or?
I was born to the downtown east side.
Oh, okay. And has, in terms of being a part of Megaphone Magazine and then being from the downtown east side, has that offered you kind of an interesting perspective into being a vendor?
Not so much being a vendor. I don't get a lot of questions with respect to the downtown east side and my involvement in it. Questions pertain more to the Megaphone itself.
Right.
The sales and who I meet on the street.
Right.
So that is more the focus.
Okay. And I guess you touched on this before. So people often don't think about why people are stuck in homelessness. What do you think are some of the reasons that get overlooked the most?
A lack of communication between those of us who are experiencing the problem and the powers that be out there, who at times are don't understand the situation well enough to be able to deal with us. They follow protocols which handcuff them,
right,
and that affects us in the long run. I feel if they could have more power, like the people that I was involved with when I was on welfare, if they had been given more power to be independent and handle our cases independently rather than throwing protocol at us every time an issue arises, I think that would go a long way to ridding us of a lot of the problems we are experiencing here in the downtown east side.
And you said, so you grew up on the downtown east side, you're from here. Have you seen, like, in terms of changes you've noticed or issues that have come up, like, what have you noticed since, as you've grown up?
Oh, there have been many, many changes over the years, but the greatest and most significant change that I've witnessed was Expo 86.
How so?
I feel that it opened the floodgates for people to come in, live in our city, and I figured that there wasn't enough preparation in terms of the educational system, which became so overburdened, the ability of schools to teach our children was significantly affected, and not in a good way. I say this because my daughter grew up in a time when the immigration was just beginning to reach flood proportions. So her education really was affected by that. The system had to slow itself down so that new people coming into the country would be able to learn along with us.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then as well, I guess, so how long have you been involved with Megaphone then?
Oh, not that long. I think this is my fourth year with Megaphone.
Awesome. That's a wild white. What are some of the reasons that you continue to stay? How have you found that it's helped you in a sense?
Well, I came over from Pivot.
Right,
the
right.
Open Shadows Calendar Project.
Right.
So I was already a vendor, so the transition was almost natural.
Right, right.
And so when I was invited by Megaphone, I said, okay, another project that can help me grow and develop in some ways.
Right.
And it's a project that also keeps me out of trouble because I am an alcoholic and an addict. So when I'm out focusing on selling the Megaphone, interacting with people that I do on the street, that keeps me out of the bars, keeps me from being active as an addict, and so I value that. And I figure eventually I'll be able to maintain a focus where I don't need to have either the alcohol or the drugs, and these projects really go a long way to provide a groundwork.
All right, I'm Una. And we're back with the CITR Homeless Broadcast, and we're sitting here today with another vendor from the Megaphone, and I'm going to let you introduce yourself. What was your name?
My name is Peter Thompson.
Hi, Peter.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Good.
Awesome. I just wanted to ask, why did you come down today to come and talk to us about the homelessness marathon or about homelessness in general?
Well, I figured that it'd be good to come down and discuss the homelessness with everybody because it's a big issue that's been happening not only here but other parts too where people are homeless and somebody should be doing something about it.
Do you have your own experience with homelessness?
I've had experience with homelessness in the past, but I have found housing. I live in the basement suite now, so.
Nice. How long have you been living in a basement suite?
About 6 years now.
Okay. So you have a real space in your heart for folks who struggle with homelessness?
That's right, because it's hard out there when the weather gets rough, it gets cold, or it's too wet. And too damn people that live in these kind of conditions develop health issues too. Okay. And it affects not them, it affects other people too.
Yeah, totally. So when you decided to come down here and talk today, is some of your experience of being homeless inform that? What's been happening over the past year that has helped kind of spur you into action around coming to talk to the general public about homelessness?
Well, I think it's a pretty good idea because homelessness is like a disease where you have to find a cure for it, and to find that cure, you have to get the right people that are involved, and the ones that you have to speak to, they're the ones that really need to hear what we have to say and the ones that should be doing something about it, not just letting it, like, say we got the mayor, he said he's going to end homelessness in certain periods of time. But a lot of these people, they take that for granted. They use that for an excuse to get voted in, elected. And the province, they should be doing something about it too, but I don't feel they're doing enough to help out people, like, and this should be a real big issue because it's not only here in Vancouver, but province-wide too, where people freeze to death or people get burned to death by just trying to keep warm, and I don't like that.
Mm-hmm. If you're not from the downtown east side, how did you get here?
I've lived in the downtown east side many years. I lived in the SRO rooms. I lived in many of the hotels down there. And I know what it's all about. And I walk the streets downtown east side every day. I go for breakfast or lunch at the Carnegie and
Going back to what you were saying about the folks who are either freezing or burning maybe in their tents because they're trying to keep warm and how that really impacted you, what are some things about being homeless that maybe people wouldn't think about that are barriers to doing things like getting a job or getting, you know, into sort of a more mainstream society?
Well, first of all, the province has got to reach out to help them out to get stable housing, not just temporary, like shelters or whatever. That's not going to help them because they're out of there. They have to be out of there 7 o'clock in the morning. And where are they going to go? They have nothing to eat. If they have stable housing, they have stable place. They could cook. They could clean themselves. They could be more what you call for themselves that they want to do. Get out and do some.
Mm-hmm. Once you found housing and you've found that you were housed regularly and you had safety around that, how did that impact the way that you were able to act in the world?
Well, it's like, you know, when you get that, you you not only think about yourselves, but you think about other people too. Mm-hmm. That is still in that situation. So you try to help them out as best as you could too, every day.
Awesome. And that brings me to Megaphone. So you have been working for Megaphone for how long?
I've been working for Megaphone for about 10 years now. Yeah.
Well, I guess in some ways Megaphone's working for you, right?
Well, yeah. We all work together.
I love that about this place. So you've been working for 10 years, but you say you've been housed for 6. Do you think that Megaphone and working here and being part of this community helped part of that process of getting you into stable housing?
Yes, I believe so, because it is something that, we all struggle for, and something like doing Megaphone gives me a stable work where I could get out there every day and introduce the paper to people, and people help me out along the way too, so... Mm-hmm.
So for anyone who doesn't know what Megaphone is or how it helps, how the vendors and Megaphone work together as a community, could you just tell us a little bit about how you interact with Megaphone?
I interact with Megaphone. I sell the paper on the street every day. I introduce it to people going by, and the people that come to me, They tell other people too what I'm selling, and they'll come, they'll buy the paper, and I show them that respect, and they show me the same respect that I give them too. So
it's your daily job?
It is.
Awesome. Do you also do the Hope in the Shadows calendars in the winter? And so how does it work? Do you you buy the magazine and then people buy it off of you?
Yeah,
how does that rotate?
I buy the magazine for 75 cents, and it's got a $2 price tag on it. But people usually pay what they want for it.
Yeah, okay, that's great. Yeah. And you have a regular spot?
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of like your workplace?
Yes.
Awesome, so everyone knows your name, and you have become a community member there?
I've been welcomed there.
You've been welcomed
by a lot of people.
That's so great. So I guess my next question is, so a lot of people don't know why people are stuck in homelessness. And do you think that there's any reasons that get overlooked the most?
Well, a lot of things that I know is the rent evictions that's happening, and the rise of the rents, like as soon as they renovate, they up the rents, and these people can't afford it. If there's other people that want to come in, and big developers come in, and they're starting to push their way into the downtown east side, and once all the rents and everything going up, people get pushed out. And that's not fair to the people that's been there for years, right? And all of a sudden they get... pushed out of their place or displaced. Mm. And I don't think that's fair to anybody.
No, it sounds terrible. We're going to close up. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts or last thoughts that you might want to share with everybody about what we've been talking about that you'd like to share with people on the air today.
I just think that this is great that this is happening, that we're doing this so that people out there will know and will take effect into wanting to help and push towards government to help people instead of pushing them aside. Like, enough is enough. They should just clear the slate, start helping these people. And, you know, there's a lot of places downtown east side where they could build places for these people, and it's not fair to them.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and we really appreciate you adding your voice to this project.
Okay, thank you.
The most powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
All Access Pass is back for season 2. We are a collectively run weekly program that discusses equity, inclusion, and accessibility issues on and off UBC's campus, including both visible and invisible disabilities. You can catch All Access Pass every Thursdays from 2 to 3 p.m. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
To my eyes, the last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5. I want you here with me at the Wise Hall Flea. Wise Hall Flea.
Hello, we are now live. I am Rachel Lau here at the Homelessness Marathon. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and I have the pleasure here to be joined with...
James Witwicky.
James Witwicky. Thank you for being here.
Witwicky.
Witwicky.
Yeah, just like the Transformers guy.
That's good to know, James. Thank you so much. So, to start off our little interview here today, I'm curious, why did you decide to come down here to talk to us for the Homelessness Marathon?
Well, because I think that myself and other vendors, Peter's a good example, we start to take ownership of the project. So when things like this come up, we want to give back in a way.
Right. And so what is it like to be able to take ownership of the project like this?
Well, I mean, over time, I've published poetry in Megaphone. I've done interviews in Megaphone. And other vendors as well. We're contributors. We have vendor profiles that are in Megaphone. So it becomes part of a community, and it becomes sometimes even a thing of like, oh, have you done one of the vendor profiles yet? Or have you been on the cover yet?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we talk about that with each other, and we encourage each other that way. So.
Right, and it sounds like you really become integrated with Megaphone and being able to share your experiences and your work with other people. So I'm sure you had a start in Megaphone, like you started somewhere. So how did you come to join Megaphone?
Okay, so in 2010, I was homeless, and I was living at the First United Emergency Shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a contest for Hope and Shadows, a photography contest.
Right.
And I took a picture of a window washer at the Pennsylvania Hotel that was selected to be in the top 40. So because of that, they had a contest, they had an award ceremony, they had an exhibit, and I began to interact with the Megaphone staff. And then they said, well, do you know that Megaphone also publishes poetry? And so I have a degree in English, and I've been writing poetry, so I started to submit poetry to Megaphone. And then that became a whole other adventure.
Wow. And so what is it like to be someone with an English degree and being able to share those things in a publication like Megaphone?
Well, it gives us an opportunity to be heard. And, I mean, Megaphone is not the only project in the Downtown East Side that gives us a unique opportunity to have our voices heard. So it's just great. It's not something I would have planned for, but
right.
The way it worked out was just good for me.
Right, and it's been 7 years now, right?
That's right, yeah.
So where do you come from? Where do you call home?
Okay, so I mainly have lived in the Lower Mainland, what they call the Lower Mainland or Metro Vancouver, since 1972.
Right.
And I lived in New Westminster from 1992 to 2010. And in 2009, my wife died in New Westminster.
I'm sorry.
And I wanted to take a slightly different direction in my life. And sort of accidentally on purpose, I wound my way down to the Downtown East Side.
Accidentally on purpose. Can you tell us a little more about that?
I had a sense. I'd had an encounter with the Downtown East Side in 1990 because of, like, I have what they would call a dual diagnosis. I have a very serious mental illness, and I've also have a history of abusing substances. So what was the question again?
You said accidentally on purpose.
So in 1990, I had been homeless for a brief time, and I experienced the Downtown East Side. And one of the things that always stuck with me about the Downtown East Side was the love of art and the love of poetry and the love of, you know, there's been few other places where people immediately react to poetry the way they do here. And so when that was the journey I started in 2010, I wanted to come back to this community. So I intentionally came back, but also accidentally came back because it's one of the few places that I would want to be homeless.
Right. And what makes the downtown east side a place where you want to be homeless at?
Well, the thing that attracted me to it originally was the fact that the First United shelter was a 24-hour low barrier shelter.
Okay.
And ultimately, it became impossible for them to continue that. But because it was 24 hours, you couldn't get thrown out. Mm-hmm. You could come into any shape at any time and crash there, which I did for 7 months.
Right. Yeah. So it sounds like the downtown east side, in terms of like the housing situation for you at that time, was both accessible and also the community, or not accessible. You're like kind of making a face, so I want to.
Well, I mean, the thing is that I don't, you know, being able to do 7 months at the First United Emergency Shelter is not everybody's cup of tea. There's some people that will not go, would not have gone there, period.
Right.
And also, I realized afterwards that was a very expensive 7 months in terms of you know, so it's just, you know, so in a way it was good, and in another way it was not ideal.
Right. And I'm curious, you talked a little bit about how the downtown east side has this appreciation for art and poetry, correct? And in what ways have you seen that when you were in the community?
Okay, well, the thing that struck me when I first started working with Megaphone was the quality of the people that were participating. And I didn't really know where they had come from or who they were, but I mean, I was impressed by that. And Megaphone is not the only organization. Thursday's Writing Collective has people from all over, like Madeline Tien was a guest writer at the Thursday's Writing Collective. Mm-hmm. And so there's people from all different walks that come to the downtown east side looking for opportunities to engage with the people in the community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that makes it maybe unique in the world, that so many people are interested in accessing this community and interacting with us. And for me, that's just been great. It's just been a ride for me.
Yeah, and it sounds like a really wholesome community to be a part of.
That's right.
So more on the topic of homelessness, people don't think about why folks are stuck in homelessness. So what do you think are some of the reasons that often get overlooked by people who aren't part of this community?
Well, for example, I can talk about my own experience of being in supported housing, which is a place owned by the Sanford Housing Society and managed by PHS Community Services. Those kind of supportive housing that can be low barrier, and that you have supports, and that you have maybe one meal a day, and things like that, right, are a good way to prevent people with dual diagnosis from being tossed back into the community. Because if you're mentally ill and you become unstable, and that happens to a lot of people, it hasn't happened to me, but you become unstable and you do something in some most kinds of housing, they'll just evict you. Supported housing is an entirely different concept, and it's frankly a little bit expensive, but it's the best way to ensure that people with ongoing mental health problems or substance problems get the kind of support that they need to be stable in housing long term.
Thank you for sharing that. This concludes our interview. So I'm wondering, James, if there are any last words you want to leave with folks who are listening here at the broadcast today.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the reasons why so many people try to engage with our neighborhood is that they understand that the standard typical media portrayal, even favorable media portrayal, always begins with the idea that it's Canada's poorest postal code and how many people have died of an overdose. But if people from outside the community want to engage with the community and really try and figure out what's going on here, I think they'll see a side that's much different and that needs to be preserved. Because like Peter said, we can't stand up against the onslaught of people that are certainly good people, students and international students and people visiting at the new hospital, but that are willing to pay way more than we could pay for those small units.
Thank you, James.
You are listening to 101.9 CITR FM. You are joining us back at the Homelessness Marathon. And we are in Megaphone Studios in the Downtown East Side. And I am joined by...
Davin Bhutang.
Awesome. So you're kind of involved with Megaphone. Can you tell us a little bit about how you're involved, how long you've been involved?
Right. So technically what I am, I'm more focused into the Hope and Shadows.
Okay, and what's that?
That's through that. It's the calendars.
Oh, awesome.
That they have, yeah. Actually, my picture's in this here, too.
you're a calendar, yeah. The face of the calendar.
I'm Mr. October.
Oh, that's a good month.
and I've been involved for probably a really bad time, probably like 13 years. For sure, it's been like a long time. When I first heard about them, I started selling the calendars, and then slowly every year I just got more and more involved, started generating income, and it's a great program.
How did you hear about it?
Let me think. I think I saw a poster at like the Carnegie Center way back in the day, and I saw them like saying, "Do you want to earn some extra cash?"
Right.
And I went in for the training.
So you said, how long have you been involved again?
With 13 years.
13 years, and what's kind of like driven you to like get involved and.
Probably most people, it was just to generate the income to make the extra money on the cash on that side. But then the more I got more involved, I went to the meetings and seeing how great the project is, then I just got more involved because it's actually about like social change and helping people. And,
right.
Yeah. So it just, sucked me in.
And so why did you come down here to talk to us today as a part of the Homelessness Marathon?
I said they had phoned, but they phoned around, and then when they told us it was about like homelessness, poverty, and all these, like these three issues are all part of my life, so I'm for sure going to come down and talk about it.
And if you don't mind asking, how's your personal view on it and your own personal experience affected joining Megaphone?
How did my personal experience affect?
How is, like, you said you have your own personal experience being homeless yourself. How did that affect wanting to be a part of Megaphone?
Oh, for sure. I said because back in the day, I guess I can only speak for myself, of course, right? But the main reason I was homeless is because of drug addiction. And then when you're a drug addict, all you're doing is looking for ways to get money. And then you go through different phases, right? So I didn't want to start. I hate stealing or robbing and crap like that, right? So to make like an honest living, it was through Megaphone. I was able to generate some income there to support my habit.
Nice. And how long have you been homeless for?
Well, during that time, it goes on and off, but the longest stretch was probably, I don't know, like 1 year. I guess it's really hard with me with time back then, but about that, probably like 1 year.
And are you from the Downtown East Side?
No. So what happened was I originally, when I first came out to Vancouver, like in 2000, I started living up on Commercial Drive.
Okay.
And then when I finally lost everything and all that, I still kind of stuck around on Commercial. But then eventually everybody in Vancouver, they all get pushed down East Side. Like I used to sell drugs, of course, right? So when I got caught, they red zoned you from Commercial and they kick you out of all the other areas and literally they push you into the Downtown East Side. And this is where they pretty much want everybody to migrate to. Well, for now. The last couple of years, they seem to be reversing it and want to kick everybody out. So it's interesting.
And how has been living in the Downtown East Side? Has it been like a sense of community for
you? Yeah, for sure. When I first came down here, I was super depressed and I wasn't involved. But then joining all these other organizations and community, quite surprising. There's a huge community down here.
Hey, and could you maybe inform us a bit more about, for people that don't know much about living in the Downtown East Side, is there anything that comes to mind about something that people don't think about or they don't consider about people living in the Downtown East Side?
We're all super close because down here, for most of us, like most of us are living in those SROs, like single room occupancies, and it's like they're super small rooms and it's all like shared kitchen, shared bathrooms and whatnot, so... So that's one thing, too, is you have to, like, we're almost, like, all living amongst each other. And even when we go to the soup kitchens and this and that, so if you have to get along with everybody, if you don't, then you're just,
Now, I guess on a much similar but serious note, a lot of people don't think about why people are stuck in homelessness. Why do you think, what reasons do you think there are that get overlooked the most?
They get overlooked. Oh, I think they all kind of know the reasons. They're just not really doing that much to change it. Like, pretty much it's just mental illness and drug addiction. And those are pretty much the two main reasons why people are homeless, especially in Canada, right? Like, if your mind's straight and whatnot, you could always get help and do this.
Right. So I guess before we end here, I guess in terms of, okay, let's say you have someone who might want to join Megaphone, become a vendor. Is there, what is kind of like your selling point to try to like convince them to get involved?
Oh, it's like one new word I'm finally learning down here is entrepreneurship, right? So yeah, you become your own boss. You literally buy the product and then resell it.
Right.
And you make your own hours. You throw in your own lines. You pretty much start be an entrepreneur.
That is awesome. So before we end here, was there anything else you wanted to let our listeners know as a part of the Homelessness Marathon, just in general?
And not really. I said just get more educated and learn more of the downtown east side and homelessness.
Awesome. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Devin.
No problem.
Yes.
All right. Once again, you're listening to the Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM on the unceded Coast Salish territory. My name is Una, and I am here with Duncan, who is going to regale us with his awesome stories of working in the downtown east side, and I'll maybe let him introduce himself and what he does.
Thank you, Una. Duncan Higgin. I'm a project manager for the PHS Community Services, and I manage the sheltering units for this organization. So we bring online about 85 funded units of shelter on a nightly basis in the downtown east side, and really pride ourselves on trying to offer truly low-barrier sheltering to a collection of people who in many regards are otherwise barred from many other sheltering environments. And so what that really demands is a real exploration of what are the barriers and limitations to having people being able to access shelter themselves.
So why did you decide to come down here and talk today? Why is this personal for you?
One, I'm very privileged to be in this space, and as you said, in this unceded Coast Salish land. More importantly, I'm really privileged to be amongst these individuals who have been previously speaking here and working for an amazing organization that offers truly meaningful labor to this group. So it's just a privilege to speak on an area that I'm very passionate about and a really underreported and little understood area of the really desperately marginalized populations of our country. I would like to say one other thing with the privilege of being here at Megaphone and whatnot. In any given setting within our structure, we're asked a lot of questions. The first question is often, what is your name? And we can all generally achieve that. But the very next question is often, what do you do? And that's a huge marker of self and of importance. And I think it's important that we mention here, with work like Megaphone and Hope in the Shadows, that we're giving and providing meaningful, authentic employment. So thank you for letting me share in here. Personally, I have witnessed the true depths of marginalization in the downtown east side through drug addiction, mental illness. But more importantly, the core elements there are often historical traumas. And those are understated elements that happen to individuals in their youth and elsewhere that we don't talk deeply about. And for me, that's an important element of the homeless conversation.
Thank you. I'm wondering what, you know, I'd say most people don't really think about homelessness or the barriers to housing that people face. And if you were to talk to the general public today, and folks who are able to listen from their cars or from inside their homes or from their streaming from their computers, what would you want to tell them to help them have an understanding of the kind of barriers that people are facing in the homelessness?
Yeah, that's a really big question, but I think some of the things we have to hit on here is this broken notion that somehow drug addiction and homelessness and marginalization are agential choices to commit illicit acts, mm-hmm. and therefore the consequences of which are entirely the individuals alone to bear. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is that we often see and perceive in the general public or the more mainstream public when we're looking at addiction and homelessness, things of that nature, we see an individual who we claim had the agential choice to consume an illicit substance, and therefore the consequences entirely theirs and theirs alone to bear. And I'd just like to elucidate the conversation a little further. You mentioned the individuals in cars. We know that 8 out of 10 car accidents are caused by speeding or distracted driving. An agential choice to commit an illicit act their consequences are never theirs alone to bear. And I think there's a big hypocrisy in that conversation. There's no one who goes to the hospital following a car accident and asks, were you speeding? What happened to these natures and whatnot? But of course, when the addict or the marginalized arrive in hospital, he said, hey, have you considered not using drugs? And I think it's very important that we look at those hypocrisies, those unequal measurements and inequalities, allow us a different and more authentic perception of what the problems at hand are. The problems at hand often with the clients that I am serving, with the individuals who shelter at our projects, drug addiction and marginalization and alcohol consumption are not the problem at hand. They're simply a coping mechanism for previous historical traumas. And I think that's a very important element, even more so when we consider in often case those traumas happened to individuals when they were children, in their youth, things of that nature. And there's a doubling of victimization. We didn't support that individual when they were a child, not their fault, be it watching domestic abuse, be it sexual abuse, physical abandonment, whatever that might be. We didn't support that child in their youth. That was not their fault. And then they turn 18 and we say, pull your bootstraps up and get a job, which is a second form of victimization. And quite frankly, it's not the bootstraps that are broken. Mm-hmm. The bootstraps work just fine. It is the fact that we have abandoned people and then blame them again for their historical traumas. I find that very troublesome and worrisome.
So what I hear you saying is that people are not only blamed, but then they're put into two categories, the deserving and then the undeserving of the same services. So some people who follow a certain narrative are considered deserving, but those are folks who have access to different types of privileges that other people don't necessarily have access to. So they're, you know, insulated by those, by their privilege, whereas other folks don't necessarily have that and are put into the category of undeserving. And so no matter what they do, no matter how they try to access services, are labeled as such. That's what I hear you.
This is precisely in many regards, you know. We have two categories, and it actually goes a little deeper than that, but I agree in full. We have the category of the worthy homeless and the worthy of treatment and the unworthy. But we also have this cultural sociological framework of constantly trying to place people into the category of wolf or sheep or wolf or lamb. And what's most fascinating about that conversation is that we then in a general population look at the homeless in the downtown east side and often describe them as the wolf, as though somehow it was catchable and contagious, historical traumas, when in reality that population in many regards is the most lamb-like of our entire population. And these injustices of the worthy and deemed worthy of treatment or of pain management or whatever that might be is doubly so when we talk about dividing our populations into predator and predation.
I really liked how you stated that. We have about one more minute before we need to wrap up. So if you have any last thoughts, Duncan, I'd really love to hear what you have to say.
Well, first off, I think it's important that we're at least having this conversation and having the voices of the individuals who live in the homeless instead of my privileged position talking about this. And those are the voices that have to be heard in forever and very long time are the least heard or understood, which means that the solutions are being created by individuals who don't live the life itself. And another thing that I like to say that I really think is important here, for a very long time, the bureaucratic structures and other structures that approach homelessness and the problem of homelessness and addiction have tried to create what were perceived as complex solutions to the notion of a very simple problem of homelessness. And we have to shift that paradigm, because what we need are very simple solutions, like the room we're in here, working with vendors, to the really complex problem of historical traumas.
While we broadcast from Megaphone Magazine to share the voices of its vendors, we felt that our programming efforts for the Homelessness Marathon could not ignore the opioid overdose crisis, which has been devastating communities across North America, in particular, the downtown east side. Considering the factors which perpetuate and exacerbate homelessness, such as addiction, housing, social exclusion, and more, along with the fact that the overdose crisis is already the most devastating for communities affected by homelessness and poverty, we felt it was essential to also focus on the activism of the downtown Eastside community and the further necessity for action in the wake of a tremendous human rights crisis. Stay tuned for an audio collage from the rally on February 21st, collected by producers Cal Murray and Jonathan Kew.
When you were starting out as a writer, you were a black, impoverished, homosexual. You must have said to yourself, gee, how disadvantaged can I get?
Well, no, I thought I hit the jackpot.
Oh, great.
It was so outrageous you could not go any further, you know. You had to find a way to use it.
Curated by Barbara Chirinos in partnership with Viv Van City Theater. The annual Black History Month film series shines a spotlight on African North American film and history. This year's program encompasses music, political protest, spiritual, emotional, enterprise, and endeavor. The centerpiece of Black History Month at Van City Theater is the exclusive Vancouver premiere of the Academy Award-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro, screening from February 24th. Other highlights include Julie Dash's seminal Daughters of the Dust, the music films Molly Blues and Sign of the Times, and a new Canadian documentary about the untold history of Black hockey players, Soul on Ice.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities.
They are doing this by developing gender-affirming, client-centered models of service.
Ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available.
And supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support.
Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for the trans members of our community.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
In April of 2016, British Columbia declared a medical emergency for the accelerated incidences of preventable accidental deaths from overdose, a problem that has swept North America as the drug market is flooded with fentanyl. This Tuesday, February 21st, join a coalition of impacted parties to march in downtown Vancouver to demand an end to this overdose epidemic. For more information, visit capud.ca or follow hashtag LifeWon'tWaitFeb21 on Twitter.
Thank you. Now I want to introduce Tracy Morrison. She's the president of Western Aboriginal Harbor Society and has been working on the ground for years in the downtown east side. And she'd like to read a letter that she wrote, a letter that she explicitly sent out to everyone. Thank you. So I call this the sad song of sirens. I am an Anishinaabe woman who resides in the downtown east side of Vancouver. I have volunteered and worked in this very diverse community for 15 years and will continue to do so. I acknowledge that I live, work, play on these unceded territories belonging to the Coast Salish peoples. Having respect for the people whose territory I live on is a must. And writing this call to action is a must, too. When I hear the sad song of sirens that ring out in my neighborhood every day, all day long, I'm dreading the story I will hear, whether this person has made it or not. This emergency crisis of overdoses and deaths has taken its toll here in this city that I love so much. It is inconceivable. It is so hard to understand why this problem can't be helped or solved. Why isn't what we are doing working? The lights of the emergency vehicles, those beacons firing off the urgency of their journey, aren't what I want to see on every block. The war on the poor must end. I believe that the war on the poor has a lot to do with this. The laws need to change. But that is a pipe dream. Instead, we as a society and residents of the downtown east side and Vancouver need to ally together to create positive changes here and now. I know in writing this call to action is not going to change much, but for me, it's a start. First, I'm going to send this plea to everyone I know, all organizations, and the varying levels of stakeholders, directors, colleagues, and friends. I want us all to be an active part of the solution, not the problem. From Naloxone to Bannock, I am proud to have taken part in hosting a Naloxone and overdose response public training event with several other agencies, including the city, health officials, VANDU, and Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society. Over 230 people were trained that day. And I also joined in on the December public forum at the City Hall that was led to the addition of targeting funding to help with the huge, large strain of the fentanyl crisis on the city police, fire services. And I also do a lot of my own outreach on the street through selling my Bannock, usually in the evenings. And a warm piece of Bannock will do you good.
Yes.
Yeah. How can I help? I also want to acknowledge all the unsung heroes in our community who are doing their part, and yet the sirens still call. More must be done. So I ask you to question yourself, how can I help? We need everyone, not just the people who reside in the downtown Eastside, but in all Greater Vancouver, the province of BC, and right across Canada. All levels of government, all nonprofits, health authorities, the VPD, housing agencies of all kinds must get on board. This is all I truly want this year for all of us to ally together. Stop the drug war. Stop the war on the poor. We all must all work together and help our people who are some of the most criminalized, stigmatized, and marginalized living here in the downtown Eastside. We have the right to live. Thank you. Miigwech.
So once again, welcome to the Vancouver action for the National Day of Action on the Overdose Crisis. Before we get going, I just want to make a few quick points. We're here, so many of us, because we feel powerless in the face of this epidemic. We feel powerless because it feels like everyone is suffering and dying so much, and there's nothing we can do about it. But there is something we can do about it. And that's why we're taking action today. When we march down the street today, we're gonna say, end the war on drugs. Because it's killing us. It's killing us one by one, and it's killing us as a whole. Because our whole community is suffering right now. But today is about turning that grief and that lack of power into action, into political action, and into demands that are a clear way forward to ending this crisis. It requires what we demand of our political leaders right now is bravery. Bravery to take a risk, to do the right thing, to end the war on drugs that is killing and destroying the most vulnerable members of our society. Right now I'd like to introduce quickly Laura Shaver from the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
Hi, my name is Laura Shaver. I'm the president of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and the vice president of the British Columbia Association of People on Methadone. I'm actually going to speak to you a little bit more once we get to another place. The one thing I wanted for everybody to take in their mind as we start is that there is a person dying every 6 hours in BC of an opiate overdose. So that's every 6 hours means four people a day. When they announced the crisis in April, we were losing a person every 12 hours, so two a day. It has now gone to four. It is not getting better, it is getting worse.
All right. So we're going to get ready to head out right now. We're going to be heading up this way, going up Jackson Street, and turning right on the Hastings. My name, by the way, is Garen Ward. I'm from the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. Does everybody have a feather? Can people with the feathers hold them up, please? There are 914 feathers. That's one for every person that we've lost to overdose. We're going to carry them with us as we march down the street. Look for the people. Look for the people in the orange vests.
Yellow. Over here. Just pick up right here.
Okay. Now I'd like to introduce Jordan Westfall. He's the president of the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs. And this is an action coordinated by them.
Thank you. Thank you. We know what will end this drug overdose epidemic. Our government has excluded us both federally, locally, and provincially from determining our own fates, from considering other options besides the ones offered to us. We know what will end this epidemic. Drug decriminalization. Full legalization and regulation of prohibited substances. Access to injectable opioids. Safe, unadulterated drugs. A place where people can use them. And support from our government to make sure that we have the ability to advocate for ourselves and for our human rights. We have 914 feathers here today. Each one represents a life lost in the last year to overdose. We want the entire march on the way out to grab a feather and bring them with you on the march all the way to St. Clair Center and Health Canada. Additionally, we are going to take Jackson Street up to Hastings for this march, and then we'll be going up Hastings all the way to the St. Clair Center, Granville. Yeah, my name is Jordan Westfall, and I'm the president of the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs. All right, we're ready to go, okay? I want everybody to scream really loud. Lives won't wait! Lives won't wait! Lives won't wait! Lives won't wait! Lives won't wait!
Lives won't wait!
North America's first supervised consumption site. We are demanding from our federal government immediate exemption for all supervised consumption sites across the country. That's nationally. People are dying every day, every 6 hours, and in other provinces every 12 hours. In Alberta, there's like 350 deaths already this year. Nobody should have to wait to use this service. No one should ever have to wait to use this service. And we are demanding from our federal government immediate exemption for all supervised consumption sites across the country. We have Al Fowler here from BCA Palms, who's going to talk a little more about what needs to change. Hello, people. Good to see y'all out here. Rock on. So, my name's Al. I'm with I'm president of the British Columbia Association of People on Methadone. So what we are calling for is we are calling for more options and opioid-assisted treatments, that whether be it the slow-release morphines, the injectable heroines, but we need lots more options in our care. Methadose doesn't do it for everybody. It doesn't do it for hardly half of us. So what we're calling for is we need more options in treatment. We need Crosstown Clinic down there, Providence Healthcare. We need them to be able to triple their services immediately to kind of relieve some stress. We're calling on the governments now. The studies have been done. The research has been done. The people are freaking dying. We know what's not working. Let's try some of these things that are working in other countries like Portugal, Sweden, Europe, right?
Yeah.
Their people aren't dying like this.
Yeah.
We had a big step. I guess China is now regulating the manufacture of carfentanil, so that's a little bit of a help. But there's probably 3 container full sitting down in the harbor right now, so we got to burn through that before we all get better. So the sooner that the options are open for our treatment, the better. We'll save our lives and carry on, people.
Ain't gonna let no drug war turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let no drug war turn us around. We're gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom's land. Ain't gonna let no prison turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let no prison turn us around. We're gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom's land. Ain't gonna let no police turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let no police turn us around. We're gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up the freedom plan. Ain't gonna let no drug war turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let no drug war turn us around. We're gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up the freedom plan. Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around, turn us around, turn us around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around. We're gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up the freedom line. They say drug war, we say
no more.
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 Lives won't wait.
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 No more drug war.
No more drug war.
No more drug war!
No more drug war!
We won't wait!
An enabled FM chip in your smartphone can make the difference in an emergency situation by allowing you to still hear critical updates. It will also let you listen to the local FM station using 3 times less battery and 20 times less data than streaming. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
Tired of the gender binary, gender policing, or just want to speak your truth?
Join CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective.
This group of radio makers is all about centering the voices, issues, concerns, and experiences of women identified, transgender, intersex, two-spirit, genderqueer, gender nonconforming, non-binary, and gender fluid folks and allies.
Anyone can join, no experience necessary.
Like the Gender Empowerment Collective on Facebook or email volunteer@citr.ca.
Our show, Babe Waves, airs Thursdays from 5 to 6 and features music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
We're going to be recording this for
just for some context, for the Homelessness Marathon podcast later. Homelessness Marathon for the past 13 years or so that's been in Canada has been sort of, you know, radio is pretty inequitable, inaccessible medium at UBC, especially CITRs all the way out on the coast. Not everyone, you know, time, money, just ability to make it out. So Homelessness Marathon was sort of a chance for us to try and bring it to people who don't ordinarily have a voice in the media. And I felt that, of course, it would be remiss to not talk about the issues that perpetuate homelessness and which affect people who live in cores of homeless communities the most. So I wanted to talk to you two, since I know you were involved with the rally yesterday. Maybe you could introduce yourselves and talk a bit about your activism in the community.
My name is Justin. I'm a social worker. I have been working in the downtown east side and in addictions and poverty, homelessness, and housing insecurity for about a decade. Prior to that, I've also been homeless for upwards of a decade, and struggled with substance use for 20 years. So those coupled together with also being educated through an academic system have given me a well-balanced approach to the crisis down here and working with people.
Awesome. I'm Una, and I've been working in addictions and mental health for the past 10 years. Justin is my partner, and we were homeless down here together 13 plus years ago, which is interesting. I don't really reflect on that very much because my life has taken such a different trajectory since that time. But it does inform, my experience does inform what I'm passionate about and where I activate and volunteer. And so I don't necessarily work exactly on the downtown east side. I do work in a satellite downtown area, but I find myself down here a lot because this is where my passions lie.
And you two were involved in the organization of the Day of Awareness yesterday?
I definitely was an organizer as part of that, as a part of the coalition towards the opioid crisis. For many years, we've been very fragmented in our approaches to working and fighting and being activists in this community. And really, one of my goals was to create a coalition between many of the different partners down here, many of the different, like Van Du and the Portland Hotel and Hives for Humanity and WARS, and just bringing in people from all over. And inviting those frontline workers as well, like ambulance attendants, firefighters, nurses, all the people that work. So in the community, just to be part of this, and it's something that we're going to continue on with. Received an email today from some of the partners that we're, you know, we need to continue this coalition working towards fighting against the systems that hold back what we can do to really work towards fixing this crisis.
I think when most people, and this is really awful, but when most people think of addiction, they just do think about the physical addiction of a drug. What are some of the barriers to ameliorating sort of the damage being caused by opioids that aren't encompassed by simply the physical?
So for me, much of the work that I do, I work from a oppression-informed approach to working with individuals. And through oppression-informed approaches, we look at all the different intersectionalities of oppression that create the space for substance use and problematic substance use to be the answer to managing or coping everything that's happened prior to this moment. And so when we look at homelessness, or being underhoused. We look at traumas, colonial trauma, intergenerational abuses and intergenerational trauma, ongoing sexual abuse or sexual abuse. All of these things create this space where we need a mechanism to cope with them because they are so far beyond what the human experience is supposed to be, or in a perfect world, how it can be. And for most of the world that we live around, especially here in North America, don't experience all of that. And there's such a small fraction. But what happens is when we live in a society that believes that their moral belief around substance use should be that everybody should be abstinent, and that's the key to the answer to fixing this problem, they are unable to understand the mechanisms in which the substance use is actually helping. And so when we look at people as whole beings, and we look at all of the oppressions as they're intersecting in that being, how can we expect them to take all that stuff away without doing the work around that? And that's not an immediate, simple fix. Mm-hmm. It's something that's a process, and it takes a continuum of work. And so when we look at adding in opiate therapies, like injectable opiates, as a process of healing, and taking away the stigmatization and marginalization of people and really allowing them to become part of the society that we live in, or in whatever means that looks like, where we take away the need to hustle every day to fill the need of addiction or substance dependence, which would be maybe costing $100, $200, or $300 a day. If we take that away and we prescribe, individuals can then actually focus on the things that make life safer and healthier, like housing, like food. Maybe at some point in time joining the economic system and getting a job. Mm-hmm. But all of those things need to be addressed while we take away marginalization and stigmatization of individuals who use substances.
I think we're under this assumption in society that everyone has the same opportunities that everyone else has. And it's really hard for folks, let's say, who lived down here maybe for a little while, and maybe they were homeless and they got clean and they went into an addiction program and they did a 12-step model and that totally worked for them. Mind you, that's, 7% of people who try that route have a successful recovery over, when we look at it over a period of 2 years, which is a very small number of people, 7 out of 100 people who try it who are going to, quote unquote, make the cut. Even folks who have that experience, who do have a little bit more knowing of what it is that happens in a place that has these intersections like poverty, mental health, intergenerational trauma from ongoing colonialism and genocide, immigration, et cetera. It's very hard to conceive that people actually don't have the same experience as you, and that their experience is, at each intersection that you add to that, it creates more and it puts you further on health outcomes. So the more intersections that you have, the least likely you are to succeed at the typical health route, what is considered a health route. And a health outcome would be something like, well, someone, gets clean, gets a job, gets housing, gets these things and moves on in the world and has this arc of it gets better. And that's not necessarily the case for a lot of people. This is a community here in Vancouver, especially on the downtown east side. We have a very active community. I'd say it's very vibrant. And some people would describe the community here as one of the healthiest in the way of everybody knows everyone else. When someone goes missing, you pay attention. You notice when someone doesn't show up at the food line, or your buddy next door doesn't get out of their tent So it's very active in that way that people are really immersed. So you're asking people, you know, the general public thinks, well, why don't people just get a job? Or why don't they just stop using? Or, you know, someone on Facebook the other day said to me, like, well, I choose my shoes in the morning. And I was like, well, you have to have a pair of shoes to choose, right? You have to have those skills in place. And if your community, where you're attached, is down here, it's going to be more difficult to leave it, to go somewhere where you're not going to have as much compassion or understanding of what it is that's going on. And so in that way, what happens is we get this kind of internalizing of the community. People don't necessarily want to leave. And so we have community-based activism that has really made a big difference. People aren't being asked to leave. We're asking to adjust the quality of lives of the people who are here. Doing Housing First projects is one of the first ways that people started really looking at that, with the Jim Green housing in the late 80s, early 90s. The PHS was the Portland Hotel Society was on the front line of this kind of work of, like, we'll get people housing and then we'll worry about the other stuff. We'll worry about the social work and whether they get clean, and we'll worry about the more moralistic pieces later on. We're just going to try to get them into some sort of safety, into a warm place where they're not freezing to death, where you don't have to use every moment because you're trying to sort of keep your reality at bay. And what happens is then people do move up through those other systems, recovery, or, you know, they get stabilized on mental health medications, or they get connected to community, to helpful community resources that really help them do other things, which includes jobs, these kind of things. So it's a really interesting process that can happen in the community down here. I don't know where I was going with that. That was my 2 minutes.
So, you know, and we look at how things are shifting and changing, like if we're looking at the opioid crisis, but we're also tying that to what housing is looking like. Mm-hmm. Presently, we're moving into systems where BC Housing is taking control more of the nonprofit organizations and how we house people. Mm-hmm. And so in that, BC Housing has a vision of, and uses the dialogue of, hard to house. Yes, they use the vision of hard to house. And so what that does is it steps away from their responsibility to house those people, because it puts the blame on them, where we're really trying to change the dialogue around individuals who have more barriers and more complexity, and really looking at in certain individuals as hard on housing. And so when we take away the responsibility and the blame on the individual and we look at the hard on housing, then all it's our responsibility to rethink how we house individuals. Mm-hmm. And we're moving into a space where when you're hard on housing and you have these new buildings that are going up, and it's upwards of $5,000 or $6,000 to redo a whole suite, and we're losing all the spaces in the downtown east side that were run by compassionate, strong, activist people that were like $500 to redo a whole suite. What we're doing is we're creating space where more powerful organizations can say, this person can't live here anymore, it's too expensive for us. And then we're looking at moving people out again, evicting people. When we live in the most expensive city in the world, and we have some of the lowest welfare rates in the country, we can't even possibly house people. The budget comes out yesterday, the provincial Liberal budget, and they're talking about how they can't raise the rates of welfare because really most of the people on welfare just want to get back to work. But that's not the case for everybody. But we're expected to live, people are expected to live within a monetary means of $620 some odd a month. 375 of that's to go to rent, and the rest is to go to living. And the only places that you can get for $375...
They don't exist anymore.
No, they do. They do exist, but there are SROs are going up in price and stuff like that. There are the subsidized ones by BC Housing that are still at $375. But, you know, we don't have the space to house people. And then we have the police have the mandate to take down tents in the street. Some of the people's only safest places to stay, much safer than some of the shelters for certain people because of all of their intersectionalities of trauma and their experience in the world and maybe due to their gender, these spaces are not necessarily the safest spaces. Yet we take away their tents and throw them away.
And their belongings.
And all of their belongings.
Yep.
And yet nobody is allowed to do that to me because I have a home and I pay some rent. It's so wrong.
Justin, Una, thank you for joining me. Speaking as someone who was at was able to be by the rally for a bit yesterday, it seemed like there is this feeling that although there's a lot of work going into compassion building, into advocacy, into joining these organizations together, that there's also a lot of political inertia because of the upcoming election, and that realistically legislative change won't be coming anytime soon. For any listeners out there who might be dealing with their own complicity, trying to address their responsibility in the ongoing crisis, how would you recommend they spend their time or reach out? What organizations can they help?
Absolutely. There are so many different things that people can do. As simple as get naloxone training will get you connected to some of the communities and the way that communities are engaging with the people who are involved in the crisis. But there's also we need public support. So the federal government has told the provincial government that the provincial government has not done everything that it can, so it's not going to get any help from the federal government. So there's more power that the provincial government could be putting into play, but has chosen not to. And the reason that they have given, that Terry Lake has given for that, is saying that there isn't any public support. And but the issue with that is, well, which public support is it that this person is looking for? And obviously it's for voters in the upcoming election, because the folks who are involved in this crisis, the folks who are ensconced in what it is that's happening down here, the folks who work with the 914 souls who have passed over the past year, the 116 that passed last month, are folks who are very for there being government support in play and introducing a spectrum of care that puts into play multiple models of help and support for folks. So everything from prescription opioids to, you know, including the slow-release morphine, including long-term treatment, abstinence-based recovery, all that whole spectrum, putting some money into that. People are very supportive of that. Right, Terry Lake. Right. Start a writing campaign, a letter writing campaign. Get the word out there that the public does support, and also ask questions. If the, you know, if an emergency responder decided that it was best practice to stop a fire this particular way, would we challenge that because we don't really know a lot about firefighting, and would we stop them from fighting this fire? Or would we let the first responders do what they do best, which is respond to the crisis? And so we have that same dilemma, but because it's considered a moral issue and a sort of a deserving of who's deserving of these services, it gets that inertia that you were talking about. So in order for us to move forward, we definitely need, one, public support, but two, joining that community-based activism that has been saving people's lives. So there's multiple places that people can do that. The different community health centers in their health authority are running naloxone training. The Drug Users Resource Center in Oppenheimer Park runs a training every day. If there are people, they will train them, so come on down. Folks who are in the suburbs who might be, you know, well, how do I get in, you know, I can't make it into the city. Well, there are, the pharmacists are now allowed to prescribe and give the naloxone kits, and they will also do a training there. There's training on websites. join forums, start a whisper campaign, come to the marches. So we have, yesterday we had the Opioid Awareness Day of Action, where we were demanding that the government take action and stop talking about what it is, so that we can actually bring the death rate down to a different level. Because 116 people, that's, 116 people in 1 month, that's brothers, sisters, mothers, those are people who are really missed in their families and with their friends. So those are definitely some first places that people can go to, and even just begin talking about it with your friends. Let's normalize this conversation around addiction, about, what is the stigma of addiction? Why do people have those questions? And beginning that process of changing the collective conscience around these particular issues. And get educated on some of the issues. Even, Wikipedia, if you look, Google Downtown East Side on Wikipedia, has some really great information on how the Downtown East Side ended up the way that it is at this point. So,
the other thing I would add is just writing your MLA, writing the provincial government officials, stating that, and getting as many people to do that as possible, to state that this is important for us to change, because, we see that a number of people pass down here, but in smaller communities in throughout British Columbia, the numbers are higher. When we look at Victoria, they had one of the highest per capita rates of overdose, and these are communities that are devastated by this, and we really need to address this. And housing, all of these aspects are all interlinked. And they're interlinked to the oppressive systems that really focus on those that are, and our government talks about it a lot, it's the middle class. Yeah, well, what do we do for all the other people?
Yep.
So, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to CITR 101.9 FM's contributions to the 2017 NCRA Homelessness Marathon. To find the podcast for this broadcast, go to citr.ca. CITR would like to extend its thank yous to everyone who made this broadcast possible. Thank you to the staff at Megaphone Magazine for hosting our broadcast and facilitating space for their vendors to talk on air. Thank you to Megaphone vendors Mark Irving, Peter Thompson, James Witwicky, and David Butank for joining us to talk on air, as well as Duncan Higgin, project manager at PHS Community Services, for also joining us at Megaphone Magazine. Thank you to the organizers from CAPID, the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs, and VANDU, Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, for organizing the Rally for Opioid Awareness on February 21st. Thank you to organizers Una Craig and Justin Van Westen for talking to us about the intersections of homelessness, poverty, housing, and addiction in the wake of the overdose crisis. Thank you to volunteers Rachel Lau, Desi Nair, Una Craig, and Carly Baker for hosting and teching the broadcast from Megaphone. This piece was produced by Jonathan Q and the CITR Programming Department. Final thank you to all the stations across Turtle Island and Canada that participated in the 2017 NCRA Homelessness Marathon, including host station Local FM out of St. John, New Brunswick. If you go to localfm.ca, you will soon be able to find all of the podcasts for the broadcast, which constituted the 2017 Homelessness Marathon from the NCRA. Thank you for tuning in.
If you or someone you know is experiencing challenges with mental health, there are lots of peer and professional resources available at UBC and in the community.
Kaleidoscope is a peer-run mental health support group on campus that meets every Monday, except statutory holidays, from 5 to 6 p.m. in Buchanan Building B, Room 307.
You can visit our website for updated meeting times and additional mental health resources at the-kaleidoscope.com.
If you live in Vancouver and need immediate help, please phone Mental Health Emergency Services at 604-874-7307 or 1-800-SUICIDE for the rest of British Columbia.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.